This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, you're looking very relaxed there, reclining in the chair with a glass of whiskey in your hand and those really tight pants on. Is this a writer's reunion?
It is, Chris. We are getting together to imagine a episode of a hypothetical season 8 of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And yes, my pants are rather tight.
Well, don't worry. I've dyed my beard blue, so we should look right
at
home.
That's what that is. I noticed there was something different about you, Chris.
Well, it has been a while since we've done an orb, but we're very happy to be back on mic, this time under quarantine and self-isolation as the virus goes around, which is one of those things where, you know, Deep Space Nine as a station would be kind of easy to lock down if something like this were to happen, and we'd have Dr. Bashir around to solve it for us.
I mean, in 20 minutes, he'd probably have it figured out.
I think he probably would, at least if he could be pulled away from Esri long enough to work on the problem.
It's an understandable problem, I mean.
So today we're going to talk a bit about the DS9 documentary. We're not going to talk about the entire documentary, which we do plan to do later on, but in light of Star Trek Picard and how that continued a story that was much loved on television, we're going to talk about the specific elements of the DS9 documentary that connect to the hypothetical season 8, the gathering of the DS9 writing team to continue the story and tell us what would have happened had the show continued on TV for the next season. So we're going to go through the cold open, the five acts, and just sort of talk through what they came up with and how we feel about it.
Yeah, sounds good.
So let's jump in with the cold open. And to refresh everyone's memory as we go along, I'm going to read a short synopsis of each part of the story, and then we'll talk about those. So let's give everyone an overview of the cold open. The story opens with the Defiant being fired upon by a cloaked ship. Nog is now captain of the venerable ship that we've all loved from the series, and in the frantic escape, he is able to lead the Defiant to the wormhole. On the other side is the station, Deep Space Nine. Cue title sequence. How did you feel about this setup for the story?
I mean, immediately, I think it draws you back in. Obviously, there's been massive changes, and they're basically they're kind of doing the same thing that Lucas and Spielberg did with Indiana Jones 4. They're acknowledging the time passage. They're not saying they're picking up right after 7, they're picking up 20 years later. And so I think, one, that's pretty amazing thought process and very interesting because you really do a lot of stuff. So immediately we see Nog on the Defiant. You know, he's the captain. And the fact that, you know, they're evading weapons fire from a cloaked ship and everything, that's super exciting. The fact that they're going through the wormhole and then you get back to Deep Space Nine there, you know, you come and you think everything's going to be okay. And I think,
right,
you know, it's a great opening because it leaves you hanging, especially since there's that cold open there with the crew then on the other side on Deep Space Nine. So it's like, okay, 20 years later, what's going on? Like, it really creates a great number of questions that you want answered immediately. And I think it's a fantastic start for a mythical season 8.
It was nice to see Defiant still in service, and it was nice to see Nog there as a captain. You might get a little bit into that small universe, small galaxy syndrome that we sometimes talk about by having Nog be the captain of the Defiant as opposed to him being somewhere else. But when we're jumping back into a DS9 story after so long, it's nice to see a familiar face. And it's also nice to know that Nog continued on and achieved that goal of becoming a captain. And like you said, maybe you feel like, oh, okay, he made it through. Everything's going to be okay, because it would be easy in this situation, as they're putting this together during the documentary, to want to have sort of a feel-good moment where, okay, this story is going to be a reunion of the crew and it's going to feel nice for all the fans. But instead, they do what we would expect from DS9 and they throw us right back into the mythology. The premise of the series from the start, which was Sisko's mission was to bring Bajor into the Federation, and that did not progress as quickly as I'm sure the Federation had hoped. And then we get to Rapture and we get to this moment where they're going to enter, but then they can't. And then they have to be sidelined to keep them out of the war. And so we find out that even 20 years later, there is still behind the scenes some distrust, some conflict in that relationship.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because the way that they're going to structure the series is, like you were saying, so much tied into the series. I think the thing that I was impressed most by most of what they come up with is just how much these guys really did remember, you know, from 20 years ago. But at the same time, how much it really continues the mission that they had for Deep Space Nine, which was to broaden the mythology. I think Ronald D. Moore even says that they would dive more into the mythology as they went through the series or went through the season if it were to continue. And I think it you can feel them pulling on all of the threads that they had left dangling. And that's neat to me that they're the goal is not here to create something new, but really truly to continue. And so I think they're definitely approaching it the way we as fans, if they really were to do this, the way we would want them to, which is to truly continue the series, but not necessarily trying to just update it for updated sake. You know, like we're not just here to try and like make it cooler or, you know, whatever. Like they're truly trying to be more Deep Space Nine, which is great.
Mm-hmm. And really continuing their story.
Yeah.
So let's continue on with the story with Act One. We rewind 2 weeks and find ourselves aboard the station, which is now essentially a religious shrine. Kira is in charge of the station, but she is now a Vedic. Bajor has still not joined the Federation, and there are few Starfleet officers remaining on DS9. Quark drops by Kira's office with a pad that reads, "Holosuite Memory Core Critical." Quark sends invitations out to all the former crew asking them to come to the station. Back on Earth, we see Miles, who is Dean of Mechanical Engineering at Starfleet Academy, with Keiko. She thinks the invitation would be a great chance for them to go see Molly, who is now 26 and a Starfleet officer, and is stationed there on DS9. Also on Earth, we see Jake, who is in New Orleans and is an accomplished writer. But when he receives Quark's invitation, he deletes it. But then, when he goes to the shower, he is surrounded by a bright light, and we see him in a white void, a la the prophet's domain. Back in space, we see Ezri and Julian. Ezri is now captain of a starship, the USS Emmett Till, and Bashir is her chief medical officer, and they remain happily married. We also learn that Worf is on Kronos with Martok, who is getting older, and Martok says that he has heard rumblings of something happening in the Bajor sector, and he thinks that this invitation would be a great chance for Worf to pay a visit and inconspicuously find out what's going on. And then returning to DS9, we learn that Quark has been holding on to everyone's bar tabs all these years, and of course he wants to charge them interest. And then finally, everyone arrives at the station and we find out that the emergency is that Vic Fontaine is dying. Only he isn't. Vic tells everyone that actually, Nog asked Quark to bring everyone back. And that's when Nog appears on the view screen to explain what is going on. But before he can do so, the Defiant is destroyed. And Nog is dead. So, Matthew, there's a lot going on in Act 1. They have set so many things in motion. I think they did a great job of introducing us once again to the characters, showing us where they are. Really, they set a solid footing to tell the rest of the episode, which I thought was quite impressive for them to come up with on the fly like this. What are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, one of the things I was thinking is that this... You know, you kind of mentioned small universe syndrome at the teaser, but I think when we get into this Act One, we really see that they've kind of negated that, you know, by putting all of these different people in different places. You know, O'Brien is still at Starfleet, you know, now, you know, being the dean of mechanical engineering, which makes so much sense. The fact that Ezri is now in command and you know, her and Bashir are married and he's her chief medical officer, which I think is great. I love that part. They even mention, you know, in the doc, the idea that they need one happy relationship. Which I thought was fantastic. I think it's also very smart for them to realize you want one good thing from what came from season 7 to be brought forward and see that continue. And so I think that's really smart. I love this idea that Worf has stayed on Kronos and that he has continued to help rule the Klingon Empire with Martok. And I love the detail that they added that Martok has heard rumblings of something going on in the Bajoran sector. And that that the reason that he's sending Worf there is this is the perfect opportunity to go and figure out what's going on under the pretenses of being invited. That's excellent storytelling. What they're doing with Jake, I think, makes so much sense because it kind of mirrors what we see in The Visitor of him with his dad gone. He really does kind of fall into that life in many ways of being the reclusive writer. I love that we get a Jake nude scene apparently in the shower, because of course nowadays that's what we would have, right? It's on CBS All Access, so they'd have the Jake nude scene in the shower, but then the bright light comes.
Except if it's on CBS All Access, something would happen, like he would try to turn the shower on and the water wouldn't come out and he would go, "The effing faucet.
Mother effing God, just..." Yeah, it would just be, he would just let out a ton of expletives. Yeah, exactly. But no, I think
and
that
then the bright
really...
light would happen. And
yes. And I think the thing that I love, and they rightly tap into, they kind of make fun of, the writers did a little bit, this idea that, you know, Vic is quote unquote dying and that's what brings them all here. But they rightly tapped into how special this program was for all of them and how much he had meant to every single one of them in their lives. And so it actually does make sense that they would all end up there. And then, I mean, as Ira said, you know, the whole thing about blowing up the Defiant and killing Nog is to say, this is Deep Space Nine, don't get too comfortable, which Deep Space Nine was very good at doing. And I guess my favorite reaction in the documentary was Aaron just like, you killed Nog, you know, and just
don't kill Nog.
Yeah. And he does go off.
Storms off.
Yeah. A really nice expletive rant. I think you said it rightly. They pack a lot into Act One. But mm-hmm. what they're doing, I think, is really setting up specifically, okay, here's where everybody is. Here's what's happened basically in 20 years to Deep Space Nine. And we're going to bring everybody back and we're going to start basically a whole new adventure for all of them that's going to last mm-hmm. throughout the rest of the season. And so this, to me, again, like the teaser, I think does such a great job of giving us so many plot threads to pull on throughout the rest of the season that I'm just like, okay, let's keep going.
Yeah. A few other observations I have is interesting with Molly, for example, that here you have the daughter of a Starfleet officer who chose to go into the service and is in Starfleet, and now she's stationed back on DS9, contrasting Jake, who famously chose not to follow his father's path. So you see that contrast and diversity in how the children of Starfleet officers follow a path. And I like that in the bar in Quark's, first of all, I think it's really funny that Quark's been holding onto the bar tabs all these years. It's just classic Quark. We see Morn. He's still there hanging out. Apparently he's in the background. And I also love another callback when Miles and Keiko are talking about whether they'll go to the station, and Keiko's saying, yeah, it would be a great chance to see Molly. And we've got that photo there of Keiko and Miles and Molly when she's little. And then right off to the side is a photo of Miles and Jules drinking together.
So, of course.
You know, that O'Brien had to negotiate that with Keiko, because we always talk about how Miles and Keiko are a very real couple. It's a real marriage within Star Trek, which we don't see very often. You know, Keiko probably doesn't want that photo sitting there next to the one of the family. And that's something they've worked out, that he can have that photo there. I imagine if you panned over a little bit more, there's probably a dartboard on the wall nearby.
Or the Alamo is still there or something.
Probably. Well, he's probably got the little figure in a little case.
Yep. He kept a few of the figures, yes.
I think so, yeah. About Worf, you know, the Worf thing, it's really interesting because what we don't know at this point, and it's really not established in this brief setup that they've given us for the story, is what is the relationship between the Klingon Empire and the Federation at this point on the timeline 20 years later? And Martok, if we read a lot into what they're setting up here, as we stay in Act 1, the Klingons, being a warrior race, Martok, being a military strategist, he's very suspicious. And what we find out as we go along here about what's happening on Bajor, if he heard these rumblings, that would certainly sound the alarms for Martok. So he wants to send Worf there and find out, you know, is it true what I've been hearing about the Bajorans and the Jem'Hadar? Let's go find out. So that's a really nice setup they have as well. And I'm glad, again, that Vic is still running after all these years. Let's go into Act 2. A Bajoran military leader, Major Palak, tells everyone that the destruction of the Defiant was an accident. Back in Quark's, we see everyone grieving Nog, and Worf says that the terms of a treaty, an unnamed treaty, establishes clear guidelines on how to investigate the death of a Federation citizen, and he puts Ezri in charge. Now, Ezri talks to Kira, and Kira gives her 3 days to complete the investigation. But after Ezri leaves, Palak tells Kira that this investigation is going to create problems. So we then see Kira asking a Starfleet officer for a favor, which is seemingly related to Palak's concerns. And then that officer talks to Jake, and that's when we find out that he is Joseph Yates Sisko. So Jake tells his brother that their dad came to him in a vision and told him to come home. So, Matthew, what do you think about this next part of the story?
What I like about this section is how it deepens this mystery, and it's creating a sense of unease about what's going on here on Deep Space Nine and what's happening with the Bajorans. I really like that. I love the idea that Joseph Yates Sisko is a science officer here on Deep Space Nine. It makes sense that in many ways he might have this kind of connection with this place, and the idea that maybe his father would return there. So I think mm-hmm. that's really interesting. And we don't see any of Cassidy, which I think is interesting,
right.
But it makes sense because they've already got so much going. I feel like she'd show up later in the season.
I just assume she's down on the planet.
Yeah, she's probably still on Bajor. And I think the thing that I really liked here is the way that they described Worf. That Worf, in 20 years of having spent his life in leading the Klingon Empire with Martok, that he's become much more of a diplomat. And so he's the one who reminds Ezri that, well, we have a way for us to be able to investigate this, basically, because of this treaty. And therefore, we can figure this out, which I kind of love, because what it does, I mean, they didn't mention this, but it there's that connection there between Worf and Ezri still, and mm-hmm. there will always be that connection. So I thought that was a nice moment, and I imagine in the playing of that moment on the show, there's kind of like that spark of recognition between them of they're on the same wavelength immediately kind of thing. I think that would be cool. And just this whole idea of introducing again, this Major Palak and Kira, and you're really this really deepens the mystery of is Kira shifty? Has she gone to a completely different side? Is she a character to which we can't trust anymore? Which that's nice. I think that if you're looking to shake things up here on Deep Space Nine, taking Kira, a character that was so beloved by the end of the series, to one that we're now, we're like, is she borderline bad guy? Is not a bad place to be here in this second act.
Yeah. At this point, as they're introducing Act Two, I think my initial reading of Kira, the very first time I watched this, was what you're saying, is she a bad guy? I don't know. As I think about it a bit more, and of course, knowing what comes up, my thoughts on that change a little bit. But, this act takes me back a bit to, if we go back to the beginning of season two with the Circle trilogy, where we've got this faction on Bajor who really doesn't want the Federation to be there. They're very much Bajor for Bajor, and they're doing things behind the scenes to try to push the Federation out. At the beginning of the second season, that made a lot of sense because the Federation had just arrived, and mm-hmm. Bajor had just emerged from the occupation, and I think it's a natural feeling that you wouldn't want another outside group to be coming in just as you're getting your freedom. It's interesting that it would resurface at this point after so many years. And as for Kira, one way of thinking of it is that she became very, is this accurate to say she became very pro-Federation by the end of the series?
I think she did. I mean, I felt like by the end of the series, Kira is much more in favor of the Federation being there. Than not.
Yeah, that's
my
feeling.
Yeah. And part of that is because she's come around to that on her own by living with these people for this many years.
Right. And that's where I'm going with my thought process, is that all those years spent with Sisko and Dax and O'Brien and Bashir and everyone allowed her to really feel comfortable on the Federation side. She never gave up her Bajoran side, and she never gave up on her faith in the Bajoran religion, but she came to really understand the other side and to accept it a lot. And I think to see the benefit of both being together. Now, here, if we're picking up 20 years later, And if the Federation presence has been greatly diminished and there aren't so many people on the station anymore, and she's now a Vedic, she's much more invested in the Bajoran religion than she was during the years that we saw on the show where she was having to fight the Dominion War and such. That connection could start to fade. I think of it here, like I know many people here in Japan who are Japanese who lived in the U.S. or they lived in Europe for many years and they became very Americanized or they became very much a part of whatever culture they were living in. And then they moved back to Japan. And the longer they're here, the more that fades. And it fades and it fades very often to the point where they just really become Japanese again entirely, even in the way that they think. And connections that you have with that person begin to fall apart because the thought process kind of that brought you together begins to fade over time. And so that could be the case, I thought, with Kira here, that she shifted so much back to just being Bajoran that she might now be on board with plans to push the Federation out. And to us, that could seem shady.
Yeah, so this is an interesting thing because I think this really leads us, you know, kind of into the Act 3 section that really kind of answers the question as to why Kira might be in the place that she is. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the thing that fascinates me the most because there's a lot to unpack there, I think.
All right. Well, let's move on to Act 3 then. Miles and Jules are discussing the investigation, but say that all they have found are dead ends. The Starfleet contingent remaining on the station is small and it has little power, so they haven't been able to find out what Nog was doing before his death. But Ezri and Molly have been interviewing people, and while they haven't found out a lot, what they have found out is that Kira and Nog had a falling out the day before he left. Now, Ezri goes and she confronts Kira about this, and that's when she's told to leave the station. Next, we cut to Worf, and we see him beaming down to caves on Bajor, where he meets Garak, who in true Garak fashion has information that others don't. He tells Worf that the Bajorans cannot be trusted, and that Kira, while on a missionary excursion, converted Jem'Hadar soldiers to become part of a new Bajoran army. And Garak thinks that Nog learned about this, and that's why he was killed by the Bajorans. And then we get another twist. Enter Section 31 and their leader, Julian Bashir. Feeling that religion is the obstacle to Bajor's membership in the Federation, the organization is plotting to destroy the wormhole to cut the Bajorans off from the prophets. So let's pick up with what we were talking about before this description of Act 3 and continue on with, you know, where Kira was going and what you were thinking there.
Yeah, so this whole thing really sets up an interesting thought process. Does Kira, in her 20 years, have a sense that the Federation is maybe resistant to Bajor entering the Federation because of their religion? Is that something? And so does she then on this journey run into, you know, and she is, you know, talking to these Jem'Hadar and you know, she's a missionary for the Bajoran religion, which I would say, I don't know if, I think the writers needed to think about this more because the Bajoran religion has never been one that's a proselytization religion that we've seen.
Right.
Like, you were free to believe it if you wanted, but it wasn't about them going to make converts. So
right.
I would say this. I would throw a challenge flag here in the writer's room and be like, we need to really think about this because I don't think that this is the way that the Bajoran religion has ever been seen on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
And if we're going to make this change, it needs to be really well thought out. Now, I say that, but I want to put through a thought process where I see how this could actually work.
Okay.
I think this could be an incredible season about Bajor finally coming into the Federation and truly being accepted for who they are and not who the Federation, quote unquote, these, you know, Federation types of with that Section 31 want them to be. That they would truly be Idic. I think that would be fascinating because, again, Star Trek Deep Space Nine has always been a show that has been about the relationship between faith and science and it not being a black or white, that it's a gray. And so that I think that would be much, if that's the way the season were to have progressed, great. If it became kind of this thing where the Federation truly is something that's basically almost anti-religion, I just, wow. Now, the advent of Section 31 being involved, that helps mitigate some of it a little bit. But still, I would rather see this continue down a road where Deep Space Nine continues that neither it's black nor it's white, it's basically the third way.
Yeah.
Then kind of becoming that dichotomy that TNG and TOS really put on Star Trek, which is it's either science or it's faith. You can't have both.
Well, that's what I was thinking when you were describing that. Now, as far as the missionary excursion goes, again, they came up with this on the fly in the writer's room,
right.
And I'm sure
yes.
that if they were really writing this for real to create the season, they would be spending more time on it, and someone probably would say, well, does that really work with our mythology? And they probably would have changed that. But yeah, as you were describing that, what you said there at the end is exactly what I was thinking. Like, if the season played out where Section 31 wanted to get rid of religion altogether, and the resolution of the story is that they failed, and the Bajorans, of course, keep the religion, and whatever religion is on Earth remains, then it's a bit of a reverse from what we would have gotten on TOS and TNG, because certainly on the original series, the message would have been, religion is always bad. It has to be exterminated. This is the message that we're sending you. It's a black and white thing, and this is what we want you to think. Because if you think how often Kirk would, I mean, often the religion in the original series would often take the form of a computer or something that was controlling the society. It's not like the Bajoran religion that we see on DS9, but then Kirk would defeat the computer and liberate the people. That was often a message that was sent there. And if we were to have a resolution to this story where Section 31 is foiled, I don't know that that would work for me, because it would create that black and white message, which is what DS9 generally doesn't do. DS9 leaves that gray for you to figure out for yourself. So I don't know if that would have been an ideal resolution for me. I think they could continue to explore the Bajoran religion in a way that holds true to what they did throughout the series, is what I would like to see, and I think they would do.
Well, I do think, though, that you can have Section 31 defeated and it not be a black and white thing, because, you know, Section 31's desire to completely eradicate all religions because they think it's divisive is definitely their point of view.
Yeah.
But it's also against everything the Federation is supposed to believe in, right? And so they are legitimately undermining Federation values by doing this. And so I think that's the dichotomy that you want, of saying the Federation does not say that anybody has to hold to any religion, but we want to say that you have a freedom to hold to any religion you want. So I think that's the thing that we would want to get to if we were going to do this story, because then again, it puts you on the side of it being gray again, right? You can choose religion, you cannot choose religion. We're not saying you have to choose anything. We're just saying that you have the choice. And Section 31 desiring to take that away completely. And what I find fascinating here is Section 31 is basically saying the Federation will become your god. And that is a dangerous position for any organization to be in, because the Federation isn't a god. It is just a governmental body across hundreds of worlds. And so to put your belief in the Federation and its values into a godlike status, that's also wrong. So it's like, I don't even think you have to be somebody who's a believer to say like, no, I'm not going to treat my government basically like a god, you know, like that it's end all be all of things. It's because that anytime you do that, you're automatically putting way too much into something that it cannot sustain that kind of hope.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And so if that message is written into the show, that as you just described it, in the resolution of Section 31 being defeated, and we actually get that message, whether it comes from Kira or whether it comes from Sisko, then that would work. Mm-hmm. And we maintain that idea that, like, the pursuit of true Idic, which gets lost often in Star Trek, could be a good resolution. What did you think about, of course, we know from the novels where this comes from, I think, well, even the end of the show, but the novels and where this all comes from. But what did you think about the idea of Bashir now running Section 31 and how would that play in?
No, that is 100% BS. That's crap on a stick, because Bashir has already been through this pull towards Section 31 and he's already rejected that. And I think that if the writers were to have gone back and rewatched the series, they would have been like, no, Julian is not the right choice for this. Now, could they have picked out somebody else in the show? Absolutely. But I think this is one of those places where their desire to be kind of relevant and maybe use some relevant ideas from television now to take a beloved character and turn him bad like this. I mean, this is not breaking Julian. Breaking Bashir, you know, this is Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and Bashir has literally been through this test before, and so to then reverse him back to this, absolutely not. I was watching every time I watch this, I want to throw something at the television at these guys and be like, come on, guys, I get what you're wanting to do, but Julian is the absolute wrong character to do this.
Yeah. And again, this is where I think they would have this discussion if they were really sitting down to produce this. It probably stems from the fact that, you know, it's clear in watching this that their memories are a bit foggy about what they had written, as mine would be and yours would be after so many years. Probably in the moment, they remembered all the stuff they did with Section 31 and Bashir. Not in detail, but just that was there. And they just threw this idea out there. But I do think that there is an influence, like you said, of modern television storytelling of, hey, let's take one of the characters that people love and who's good and let's make him a double agent. Let's make him bad. Because they do that too much on TV these days, in my
absolutely.
Opinion.
For the most part, I did not feel, you know, having seen some of the new Trek with, you know, Discovery and Picard, I didn't feel an over modernization here. I did feel it really like this is a continuation for the most part. This was the only section where I think they really truly do that. And even the section that they edit in here, you can tell in the edit of the documentary, this is a section where they were having this discussion after they were actually having another part of the discussion and they kind of came back. Like, I feel like the Julian thing and the Section 31 thing, they were kind of spitballing and they weren't completely sold on this idea. But yeah, actually to have him do that doesn't make sense. But of all the Section 31 that we're getting in New Trek, this feels the most legitimate. This feels like the Section 31 that we know from Deep Space Nine, and it doesn't feel like, oh, we're just going back to the well again, because, you know, even Iris said, you know, I know they've used it in the movies, but we created this. And I think they're using it legitimately here in a way that makes for, as we were talking about, if you went down that road that we talked about, I think you have a very interesting, very Star Trek Deep Space Nine message to get across that would have been phenomenal and an actual good use of Section 31. And this also might have been one of the places where maybe this is also the season where they get rid of Section 31 forever. You know, maybe this is the season where they can unravel that as well, so that this is not something that they can continue to lean on over and over again. So,
yeah, that's a good point. That would be an interesting thing for DS9 to do. And yeah, he mentioned that they used Section 31 in the movies. And we should point out that they recorded, you know, they filmed this documentary and they had this meeting long before Discovery used Section 31 in season two of that show. And in my opinion, displayed a complete lack of understanding of what Section 31 is and used it in a way that really made no sense.
That's shocking.
So having them here, it would be nice to see DS9 do something with Section 31, because these writers created it and know what it's supposed to be and where it's supposed to go. Let's move on to Act 4. With tensions between Bajor and the Federation rising, Palak is concerned that the Bajoran government may be implemented in a crime. So he pressures Kira to get rid of the Federation, something that she may be more willing to do given her own worries about the Federation uncovering her secret Jem'Hadar army. Then we see Jake in the cargo bay and he meets Joseph, who says that Section 31 killed Nog because they knew that he was aware of their plan to destroy the wormhole and the prophets. So, Matthew, Section 31 has a plan to kill the prophets.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you would be trying to kill beings who are outside of space and time, who already have been shown to be able to interfere within space and time when they so desire. So, it doesn't seem like the best plan. I love the arrogance of Section 31 trying to kill the prophets. I think that would also be one of those places where you could, if you write this well enough, you could you do the season where it's like, did the prophets make this happen or did it just play out the way it was supposed to? And that's, again, another one of those nebulous questions where it's like Deep Space Nine leaves it for you to, you can make either interpretation. So I love that kind of thought process and this whole idea that the Bajoran government might be implicated in a crime, this idea that maybe they were the ones responsible for blowing up Nog because of this secret about, you know, like, I love all of this intrigue. Again, it's very Deep Space Nine. It feels so much like you were talking about with the Circle episodes in season two, and then everything we, you know, came to know throughout the later seasons, you know, starting with season five. So this really, I think, makes a lot of sense. And then this idea of Joseph meeting with Jake, you know, I love this kind of starting to connect the brothers together, or the half-brothers together, and him revealing that he's found out that it was Section 31 that killed Nog, and it's because he knew about their plan to kill the prophets, which, dang, this is getting hot.
Do you think that if Joseph knew that there was a plan to kill the prophets, he wouldn't go to someone in Starfleet and alert them to this?
I'm wondering, see, and this is where I think that you could also do a good job of creating this sense that the Starfleet out here has kind of become slightly marginalized because of this feel that the Bajorans are feeling from certain aspects of the Federation, to which have all been orchestrated by Section 31 for them to feel like that. And therefore, Joseph's in this place where he doesn't feel like he can really trust anybody in Starfleet with this information. So I could buy it. You know, again, this is me kind of filling in details that they would have written in that you would have found out throughout the season. So I could totally see that being the case of why he goes to Jake, because obviously he knows Jake is in league with O'Brien and Bashir and Ezri and all of these people that have an opportunity to be able to handle this in a way he can't.
Mm-hmm. And there's so much set up here when we think about an entire season. The fact that the Bajorans are worried that they could be implicated in a crime that's actually something that Section 31 has done, but I think they're especially worried about it because they've got this other thing going on over here with the Jem'Hadar army. Like, they are up to something. They might just be implemented in a different crime than the one that they're planning, or the insurgency that they're planning anyway, whatever's going on. But there's so much here to play out over the course of a season that the story could be really, really rich when we think about season 6 or 7 of DS9 and what played out over the course of that season. There's so much going on here. So they do set up a lot. You were talking about the effing hubris of Section 31. I'm going all CBS All Access on us here.
Hubris.
Of thinking that they can kill the prophets, these beings who exist outside of space and time. But rolling back before that, when you were talking about the idea that their view that religion must be completely exterminated, and we think about Sisko's role as the emissary to the prophets and his role in the Bajoran religion, and then Kira here as a religious leader. It's an opportunity in the writing, perhaps, and I don't know how this plays out given that Sisko reappears, spoiler alert, at the end of our discussion here. But if you think about the fact that Sisko is with the prophets at this time, and Section 31 is going to try to kill the prophets, maybe that's a way for Sisko to re-enter the story and play his role in representing the prophets to overturn what Section 31 is trying to do and to champion that idea of Druidic and end the season with that message that religion is fine for those who want to believe it, and it's also fine for you not to believe it. And if we're going to really uphold that idea of Idic, then it's something that we have to be accepting of. It would make sense for him as a religious leader and as the captain of the show to be the one that delivers that message. And it could then lead us into a 9th season where maybe Sisko has returned.
Yeah, I think, you talking about that. So Act 5 is the act where the entire crew, they're gathered at Quark's, and they're kind of frustrated with the fact that Kira is going to kick them off the station, and they don't want to go.
Yeah, so let's give an overview of Act 5 for everyone. Kira has ordered her former crewmates off the station. They don't want to leave, of course, and have gathered on the promenade, but when a confrontation between them and Bajoran security ensues, Kira comes in and she sides with her old friends. And it looks like all hell is going to break loose. There's a face-off, but just before that happens, there's a bright light and Sisko reappears. He appears on the station, on the bridge of the Klingon ships. He appears everywhere simultaneously, and he appears in his old office where Jake is holding the baseball. And he just says, "I'm sorry." And then the episode ends on a cliffhanger. And Sisko appearing everywhere at once kind of reminded me of the Organians from Aaron to Mercy in the original series. But it also makes sense here with him being at the Prophets. So continue on with what you were saying before my overview there.
Yeah, I think so. The thing that this really does is by having Sisko come back, you immediately are able to begin the process of releasing the tension, at least that's on the station now, and allowing the rest of the season to be able to work out what's going on behind the scenes with Section 31, to uncover this mystery, to be able to set into place, if we're going to go with specifically the army and everything. I think this is the other place where this season would have to bring in Odo and the idea of the founders and what's going on with them, with the Jem'Hadar and all that. And maybe there being a way in which Sisko, as the emissary of the prophets, and in his return is able to facilitate the thing that Sisko, the captain, never could, which is bringing Bajor into the Federation in a way that respects what Bajor is and who they are as a people that could never have happened before. But also, thinking long term, that this is a way to be able to rehabilitate our view of the founders and the Jim Hadar and the Vorta, and that in some ways this is not just about the healing of the relationship between Bajor and the Federation, but this is about healing the relationship between the Dominion and the rest of the Alpha Quadrant. And so you kind of create this, I think, a really interesting aspect for that. And with Ben coming back as a god, basically, how you write all that is going to take a lot of thought.
Yeah.
But I also think him just saying, "I'm sorry, Jake, I lost track of time," is classic Sisko. You know, like, it just feels like something that Ben Sisko would say. So I think for the most part, other than my absolute hatred of the idea of Bashir and Section 31 and him being their leader, the rest of this, I think it's... They're doing everything they need to do to draw on all of the strings that they had hanging and finding new and interesting ways to wrap all this up into a new season. So,
yeah, and I think that point that you make about rebuilding the relationship between the Dominion and the Alpha Quadrant powers, Alpha Beta powers, could be the storyline of season two. Like the resolution of season one leads us into that. And then maybe Odo comes back right at the end. Maybe he comes back in the finale. And after this episode with the cliffhanger of Sisko reappearing and saying, "I'm sorry, Jake," I imagine that the, well, in DS9 fashion, it wouldn't be labeled part one and part two, but I very much see the next two episodes after this as being a two-part story. Essentially, you know, very highly connected, because Sisko's return is something that you're not going to just treat haphazardly. It's not going to be, "Oh, Sisko's back." There's going to be a lot to that. I think they did a really good job in Act 5. I don't have a lot of thoughts on Act 5 because it's very brief, and you can tell that the big idea was to bring Sisko back, to have him reappear. And as you say, the writing of that would take a lot of thought, and it's not something that they're going to do in this little gathering that we see in the documentary. But boy, it really sets up the season so well. It's such a powerful cliffhanger. It's the moment that fans have been waiting for. Sisko comes back. But the way he reappears, it's not like he's suddenly thrust back as a corporeal being tossed onto the floor of the promenade and, "Oh my God, I'm back here. You know, where have I been?" It's not like that. It's like he's still in his role as the emissary. And I also love, because we have that moment here in the office, the fact that the baseball's there, even earlier on when we see Kira sitting there and the baseball is right there on the desk. It's always that acknowledgement, I think, especially on Kira's part, that Sisko's coming back. At some point, he's coming back, because that was always what that baseball meant. If the baseball was there, then he's coming back. And sure enough, here he is.
I think one of the things that would be really interesting as well is that by creating all of this tension in this part of the galaxy again, you kind of have a reason to be able to want the Emmett Till to be around. And you have kind of a reason that you could bring back O'Brien for this season, for him to be more apart, because he's maybe worried about his daughter, and there's some part of the mystery, and this could be kind of interesting. Have Bashir and O'Brien be a part of the team that is uncovering the Section 31 stuff again, kind of harkening back to what they did, because they did it really well last time. And we also saw O'Brien going on the mission with the Orion Syndicate in Season 7, so I think that creates a really fascinating way to put those two characters that we love so much together. And again, it creates this story need for these characters to be together that's much more organic than some things we've seen in Star Trek Picard.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Well, that's the opening episode of season 8 of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, as rather hastily put together by the writing team and the DS9 documentary. And I'm glad we finally got to talk about this, Matthew, because it's been a long time. We really supported the documentary, of course, when it was being developed. And then life took us down some different paths here in recent years, and we haven't been able to talk about it. But at last, we've at least been able to touch on this aspect of it.
Yeah, it's super fun, and I really enjoy rewatching the documentary. It was on sale on Apple TV, and it was $9, and it was in 4K. And oh my gosh, we were talking about before we started recording, but the footage is just so glorious.
Yeah.
I just, more than anything, I want the show, because I've been doing a really, really slow rewatch. I'm in season two. Every time I'm watching it, I'm thinking, I know what this show can look like now. I want that.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I have to pick up that 4K copy that you're talking about, because of course I have the Blu-ray, which you have as well, because we received them as backers. But to see that in 4K would really be glorious. All right. Well, it's been great talking about the DS9 documentary and season 8 of Deep Space Nine, but it's not the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
Narek is a character not really working for me right now.
You don't like the sexy, sultry bad boy of the Romulan Empire?
Oh, I guess, but I don't know. Sometimes I think of, like, if he's the sultry bad boy, it's kind of like if Ross from Friends were the bad boy, like he's trying to be cool. I don't get it.
He really likes leather pants, too, so.
Earl Grey.
And Data's head gets sewn back on his other body, so we have two different parts of Data now.
Okay, so by sewn on, do you mean like stitched with fabric?
Well, how else are you going to attach a head to a body?
Electromagnetic interlocking.
But then with the skin? Well, yeah, you know.
Primitive Culture, a look at history and culture through Star Trek.
Asking the fans what they want is a kind of folly. They'll know it when they see it, and they'll reject it if it's crummy. Somebody said to me early on, well, you can't kill Spock. I said, sure you can kill him. The only question is whether you kill him well.
To the journey!
Something drastic like that must have happened, because that's my big question. Like, okay, why does Seven feel like she has no family? What about her Voyager family? Yeah. Where are they? Why aren't they in her life? It could be she's self-isolating. For some reason, she just kind of fell out with everyone and has been hanging out in the former neutral zone for some reason or
she's
another.
She's looking for toilet paper.
Looking for toilet paper? Do the Borg need toilet paper?
Everyone needs toilet paper.
Can you imagine what a Borg toilet would look like?
It would be green.
Well, probably.
Yeah, you remember when they had colored toilet paper?
No.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find our podcasts everywhere you get podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit subscribe in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop on your Mac to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And if you're an Android user, you can find us all over the place. Google Play Music, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud. We're all over the place. So just search wherever you get your podcasts, Trek FM or the name of the podcast, and we should come up. A few of our shows are not available everywhere, but the master feed should be available pretty much everywhere, and that contains every episode of every show, plus some special things that we put there as well. So you can get the shows in those places or go to our website, trek.fm. You can stream from the show pages. You can download the MP3 files and grab the RSS link. Of course, we'd love to hear your feedback on today's show. The best place to share your thoughts is in the Babel Conference on Facebook. That's our listeners group. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it should come right up. It is a closed group, so if you're not yet a member, you'll need to answer a couple of questions, and then a moderator can let you in. You can also find us in social media, where our username is TrekFM on Twitter. And you can also find us on Facebook on our main page, facebook.com/TrekFM. And we're also on Instagram. And if you'd like to contact us by email, you can do that by going to trek.fm/contact. Choose a show, choose the orb, and that'll come to Matthew and me both by email. Now, Matthew, you these days are far, far busier than me, but when you're not sitting in front of your TV, just enjoying those scenes of Esri in beautiful 4K, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero. I'm in there the same name, MattRushing02. I'm also here on the network doing the 602 Club with Christy Morris, as we're talking about all the fandoms we love. It's our general geek show, so every week we're picking out something we love. Obviously, it's been a little different because we haven't been able to go to the theater to talk about anything new, so we've been diving into some old school stuff, which has been so much fun, some things I haven't seen.
I think that's great.
Yeah, some things Christy hasn't seen, so that's actually been kind of fun, and really hope that people will check us out. I'm over on the Nerd Party Network, and I do two shows over there. One's called Owl Post. I do that with Drea Kaufman, and we talk about Harry Potter each and every week, one chapter at a time. And then I'm on Aggressive Negotiations as well over there with John Mills, and we talk about Star Wars each and every week. So much fun to join us. But Chris, if anybody maybe wants to catch up with you and reminisce about maybe some ideas they have for the rest of the season 8, where can people find you?
Well, the best place to find me is on Twitter. That's where I'm most active. I use Twitter a lot. I'm doing rewatches right now. I just finished Voyager, and now I'm into Enterprise. And of course, I'm watching Picard and various other things all the time. And I tweet a lot of comments, and I love interacting with people there. So go to Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. Again, that's the best place to connect with me, although that is my username everywhere in social media, so you can find me wherever you are. And in terms of podcasts, I'm trying to get back into podcasting a little bit now that my life has drastically changed and I lost my job, although I'm still doing some of the same work as a freelancer, but I'm home now in my studio. I'm currently under quarantine by order of the government in Japan, and that's because my son was in London for study abroad and he came back. And so we've got to be tucked away for a while. So that gives me a little bit more time to do some of this stuff. So hopefully we'll have more episodes of The Orb coming up in the future, as well as The Ready Room and Notes on the Edge, Notes on the Line, all these things that I do. But you can always go back to the back catalog and listen to the many hundreds and possibly close to 1,000, I don't know, episodes, or at least hours of me talking about Star Trek from various shows, because I used to host Warp 5 and Matter Stream and Continuing Mission and lots of things I don't do anymore. Plus, we've got this great back catalog here with Matthew and me on The Orb and lots of episodes of The Ready Room where we talk about DS9. So check all of that out. Just go to trek.fm or go and look up each show in your podcast app and you can find me doing all of that. And I do have writing on the official website at startrek.com, which I used to do a few years ago. I haven't written anything in a while. I may try to get back into that. And you can read some of my thoughts there. But yeah, those are basically the places to find me these days. I have not been so active, but I hope to be more active in the near future. Now, if you would like to have all of these podcasts continue, we do need your help at patreon.com. The cost of operating the network is quite high, and to be honest, our support has been slipping month by month for quite a long time, and we're now at a point where it's becoming difficult to fund the network. And we do need everyone's support. If you enjoy the shows, every little bit helps. We do have different levels, different perks at those levels. We have opportunities for you to become an associate producer, to get on mic with hosts and fellow listeners on the Patrons Roundtables. And we're going to be looking at other ways to provide things to those who support us on Patreon. So if you would like to support the network, please head over to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And support us there. I'm going to be updating the page soon to reflect some things that have changed and some new things that we're going to offer. And we really do hope that you will help us out, because it does require a lot of money to host and distribute these shows each month. We have a whole infrastructure in place that is necessary for all of our hosts to coordinate and to put the shows out. And then, you know, bandwidth and things cost us a lot as well. So please head over, and we really appreciate any support that you can provide over at patreon.com/trekfm. And speaking of associate producers, I would like to extend a huge thank you to Norman C. Lowell, William Murray, Kay Elizabeth Shaw, and James Muldrow for their support of The Orb through Patreon in the past as associate producers. And thank you so much. Without your support, we would not be able to keep things going. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to doing another show with you soon and diving into some aspects of DS9 that we've been planning to talk about for a while, and some others that maybe we haven't even thought about yet.
Chris, that sounds like it'll be a lot of fun, and we do want to say thank you so much for joining us. And we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.
Recording.
Esri's Captain Pants.
Oh yeah, I should do one for this, right? Riders Reunion Pants.
Ooh. Wow. Yeah. Some of those guys had some tight pants on, I'm not gonna lie. And they shouldn't be wearing tight pants, I'm just saying. So yeah. And doesn't Ronald D. Moore look like he's like George Lucas's brother these days?
Oh, a little bit, now that you mention it. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah. I mean, he's got the, like, big chin and, like, yeah. So, he looks like George Lucas's hippie brother.
Let's just hope that if they do release DS9 on Blu-ray, he doesn't go back and start changing it.
Well, what was it? Somebody, there's a new, like, upscaling technique that was going around on Twitter that they were showing. It was like, do that! Like,
at least do that, right?
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't. How long would that take them to release that and put that in at least HD? Like, that seems like a process that they could probably do in a few weeks with every episode.
Yeah, I mean, it'd probably take a while. It's probably a lot of processing power, and then you've got to package it and all that. But yeah, they could do it in a reasonable amount of time, right?
You're basically doing a thing that literally is a process that only computers are working on. You know, and if you wanted to spend some more time on it, you could. But like legitimately, that at least makes because this documentary obviously shows it's possible to make Deep Space Nine look amazing without having to basically re-engineer the entire show. Like every time I watch this documentary, I'm like, I want Deep Space Nine in HD so badly. It looks so good. Esri looks so hot. I mean, that's
I'm picturing something now like the SETI at home where people can use their spare processing power for something. How about DS9 remastered at home?
I'm honestly surprised, because there are fans that have those kind of computers. And I'm surprised a fan has not started this process of just taking, you know, basically the DVD rips and creating, you know, this. Because, yeah, I'm just surprised. So,
well, maybe we'll eventually get it, but
I hope so.
I still, as I always say, need it for streaming. Like, I think that's a thing, too, because when I watch, I think, like me, so you have a 4K TV now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what size is yours?
It's 55.
55?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I bought a 65, and when I watch these SD shows on that screen, it just really makes you wish they were HD because once you go up to that size, but also you go up with that number of pixels to 4K, then everything really looks incredibly fuzzy.
So I bought the documentary in 4K on Apple TV because it was $9. And the way that the show looks in 4K incredible. I mean, the footage just looks so beautiful. And so it's a travesty because this show is legitimately the best looking show of all of the Star Trek series with its lighting and everything. I think honestly only Enterprise really had that same kind of thing where a lot of the sets, they really had the lighting worked into the set, you know? Yeah. So yeah, anyway, it's frustrating.
All right. Well, let's jump into the real discussion here. So, I don't even remember how to start the orb anymore. What do I do? I'm like, welcome Niners, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.